My father passed away when I was 12, and very quickly, between my mom and me, we had to figure out how to make things happen. So she started. We are Punjabi, so a Punjabi lady knows how to stitch, etc. At least the generation of those Punjab, people would know. So she picked up stitching, fixing people's clothes, at our own home. And for me, it was like, okay, while she's busy with that, what can I do? What can I do to make things happen for us? Very quickly, I would start doing odd jobs. I was least interested in studies from that point onwards. And for us to find out, whether the product is, for the lack of any better analogy, a vitamin or a painkiller for them, was that we were watching our own dashboards. And when you see that the usage of CleverTap went from, once every week on Friday, just to see how the bookings were doing, to multiple people logging in during the weekend, and then everyone in the company logging in all days of the week, that's when you know that you're getting more and more entrenched in their business. And it's not like a nice to have, hey, let's go check CleverTap's dashboard because it's Monday morning, boss asked for some report. It is not that. Actually, they're fully dependent on that. And that to me is like a vital moment for you to discover that, you've discovered product market fit.
Anand's story seems like a random collection of ups and downs at first glance. His father passed away when he was young, which pushed him into the world of entrepreneurship. Anand sold detergent, assembled computers, and even installed bird spikes. He learned sales early on. As computers took over India in the early 90s, Anand taught himself how to code and worked in a US startup before returning to found Burp, a restaurant discovery app, which got acquired by Network 18. He knew software. As Anand grew into his career, he noticed that while shopkeepers remember the tastes and preferences of their regular customers, online websites do not. He had an insight. Combining a big real-world problem with his ability to write software, as well as his skills to sell it to some of the world's largest companies, meant that CleverTap was set up for inevitable success. Join us on this week's episode as we talk to Anand about his incredible journey building CleverTap.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of A Junior VC Unfiltered. I have with us this week Anand Jain of CleverTap, and we have quite a journey to talk about CleverTap and Anand's entire professional career before that, leading up to it, and what he's up to now. So, Anand, great to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, first up, if you could be a profession in any other field unrelated to your current work, what would it be and why?
There are two, three things I can think of. I would be a very good parody songwriter. My sister always I mean, this has nothing to do with technology. My sister always teases me. I am very quick with these things. I come up with things on the fly. So take any popular song and I can just twist it out of shape. So that's one thing. I'm not sure it's a career or not, but hey, I just have fun doing this. And the second thing, and if that doesn't work out, the second thing would be, I love to trek, and I've trekked in the Sahyadris, I've trekked in Himalayas. I would love to do something around that. Maybe, start a company or become a Sherpa to some other trekkers. Either way, it's going to be, I would make the most out of it.
Nice. And so what's on your bucket list personally? What are some items that you want to check off?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have too much of a bucket list from where I started in life. It's a bonus round since then. So very grateful to whatever I have seen, and absolutely have zero FOMO around the things that I've not yet seen. Of the things that I picked up recently is going to tiger safaris. So I visited a couple, and there is one more plan, which was in December during the Diwali weekend, which was like about 4 6 weeks ago, and then I went again during the Christmas break, and I'm planning to go to one more during end of March. So that's something, not sure it's a bucket list or not, but yeah, that's something new I picked up, and I'd love to do more of that.
And what about trekking? That's been a hobby for a while. I take it.
Yeah, I think easily 10 years, and we have a very small group. We go out. We mostly go out in the Sahyadris, It's fun all times of the year if you avoid the humid part, which is March through late June, July, early July. Outside of that window, there's all the other months. And I also trek in the Himalayas. I've done quite a few treks, yeah, that would be the other thing, bucket list, but like go frequently on treks.
Sure. And so this is one question we ask. It's kind of our way of getting some insight. What is one question that you would ask yourself if you were the host of the show? So we'll ask it back to you again.
Oh, wow. as the host of the show, what would I, yeah, what motivates you would be a good question. Do I need to answer it or I can just get away by asking the question?
we will make sure that you answer it. I'm sure you will talk about your motivations over the course of this podcast. So looking forward to it. Moving on to business related topics, bootstrapped versus funded?
Funded.
Okay. And why is that?
Funding actually validates your idea. So there are three validations. Number one is, getting customers or having an audience is one validation. The okay. second validation is, convincing employees to join you or other people to join you in your mission. That's the second validation. Third is capital from an external source. Capital actually makes it real. So it's not like a friend just encouraging you or, family doing that. Actually, capital means that they've gone okay. through the idea. And the perch at which the VCs come from, they've seen many businesses. And they also help you out. So I would say that funded better than bootstrap. Also gives you an accelerator when you want to grow faster.
No, fair enough. If you were to describe CleverTap's culture in three adjectives, what would that be?
I think customer obsessed would be one. Meritocratic would be the second, and absolutely right, fun place to be in would be the third.
Nice. Okay. Sounds like, yeah, I would love to kind of dive into that a bit more as we go through our conversation. And what's one truth that few people agree with you on?
So I've not gone and validated my truth with multiple folks, but I think that you pay it forward and it comes back to you. Now, it's not that people don't agree with that, but very few people actually do it. So I've always believed in paying it forward.
Yeah, a lot of people say it, but how many people actually follow through? No, good point. So thanks, Anand. Now let's dive into your journey. You started off as an entrepreneur relatively early in life. Can you walk us through where you grew up and how you kind of started on your first venture?
I grew up in Ahmedabad, and I was there until I was 25 years of age. Entrepreneurial is something that I did not know I was. It was like a forced thing. We had a death in the family. My father passed away when I was 12. And very quickly, between my mom and me, we had to figure out how to make things happen. So she started. We are Punjabis, so a Punjabi lady knows how to stitch, etc. At least the generation of those Punjab, people would know. So she picked up stitching, fixing people's clothes at our own home. And for me, it was okay, while she's busy with that, what can I do? What can I do to make things happen for us? Very quickly, I would start doing odd jobs. I was least interested in studies from that point onwards. So not that I was a genius in from an academic perspective, but I think that quickly faded my interest in studies, and I was out and about trying to figure out if there's something I can do to augment the household income. And I started fixing electrical stuff. So I could do the basic stuff, but I could repair a mixer, I could repair someone's iron. I could go and do the usual basic electrical stuff. I started doing that, and of course, as the word spreads, people don't want to go across the road. They give it to the electrician; they would just send it over to my place, or I would go pick it up.
You started this just fixing it at home, and how did this? How did you realize that you?
So
you go and take it apart. How did you know that this is something you're good at?
So I've always one thing that has been constant in my life is learning by doing. I'm not much of a theoretical guy. I don't read books. I do read books, my share of books, more so now than before. But it's not that if it's written in a book, like, you know, I will put it up on my desk or pin it up on my desk and start doing it. So for me, the best way to learn is to actually try it out, right? From a very early age, I would kind of open up things in the house, like, you know, so we had a blender, we had all these things, like, you know, I would open it up. Dad had a screwdriver, so I'd go around. And that, to me, was like a big mystery. How does this all work, right? So if you open up electronic watch, you don't see there's anything in there. It's a circuit, right? But I did not know what a circuit was. And I was always curious, how the hell does the watch know the time? Or when you open up the television, of course, you need to have your mom take a 2-3 hour nap. And then you get all the time in the world to open up the TV and you figure out, how the hell does this work? Like, you know, I don't see anyone in there. And there's an antenna on the terrace. So I think I'm an extremely curious kid. And if you look at things I've done even after that, right, they're kind of unrelated, because you don't need to build upon what you have, learned from a domain in the past. You can just take something, be curious and have a zero day hypothesis on that, and then just pick it up and learn everything about it.
Absolutely. So walk us through the journey. So you started fixing people's gadgets and charging for it, I assume.
Fixing electrical stuff. It was good. Like, you know, I did it for 2-3 years. And then you realize that, you know, this might sound very awkward, but the rich people actually have electronic devices. They have VCRs and they have cordless phones. And they have better looking television sets with remote control, right? So you go beyond electrical to electronic devices. It would start with simple stuff. Okay, my cordless is not working, and you bring it, you open up the screws and you see that something is busted. You take the whole damn thing to the electronics market and you try to find, like, that particular, you know, whatever it said. I did not know, like, you know, one transistor or resistor from the other. Said whatever it said, it looked like, you know, that it was busted. Or had a dog, like, yeah, it burnt out. Like, you know, just go show it to the shopkeeper. They'll say, yes, you know, we have this. And then you go solder it back and the thing starts working. So I started doing this, my learning journey started there. But very soon I taught myself how to fix electronics. And I had a field day doing that. So from electrical to electronic. While all of that was going on, I also, like I said, I was very opportunistic. I was more opportunistic than entrepreneurial, but, you know, you have to make opportunities work. We figured out that I can get access to soap from a very popular detergent factory near Ahmedabad, right? So I could get hands on that. That they were discarding that, thinking of that as waste. And a friend's friend was responsible for...
You must have been like, what, 14, 15?
Yeah, I think 14 or 14 and a half, 15. Yeah, someone's discarding waste because my friend's friend got a contracting job to go clean up the factory. We are just hanging around one day. And he said, you know what, this is the funniest thing. Like, you know, they want everything spick and span. And I said, what do you do after you clean up? I mean, after you gather all the, you know, the dust in the factory, it's like we go somewhere outside and dump the whole thing. And you realize that, okay, it's a chemical factory, right? Like, what is in the air? Well, it's only detergent, right? Because it's a detergent factory. So what's on the floor is also detergent because, you know, there are people that wear that whole thing. The white suit kind of thing, right? So it's not that they're inhaling it, or it's not like there is dust from the windows or the door. It's kind of a sealed factory. So I said, why don't you give that to me? And that's how I got my hands on sacks full of soap. And, you know, with that candle and then a little plastic wrapper, I would plastic pouches. I would put this in a plastic pouch, seal it, and then go door to door to sell it. Because who would know that Anand is selling soap? So I have to go door to door. Thankfully, yes. I used to live in a high-rise tower, a 10-story building, and we had 4 blocks. So it started with, you know, walking door to door in our own apartment building. I'd ring the bell.
What?
Yes.
Just go on.
And I'd say, hey, I have soap. And they're like, okay, no, we actually use the a branded soap. We're like, okay, this is the same soap without the brand. And you know what? I'm willing to sit here for like 30, 40 minutes until you wash the clothes and you can check out the quality. And then they would, because I was you know, I had all the time in the world, and I would sit there, and then and if you think about that, how life comes back, because that became a subscription business. Like, you know, when the soap ran out, they came back to us. They came back to me for more soap.
Selling soap.
So I had a lot of fun doing all of that. You know, then I started assembling PCs. I self-taught myself how to write software. So a friend had a ZX80 and a Commodore 64 PCs. You know, I would go spend the entire night at the guy's place writing software. And then your interest, because you know, PC circuit boards and, you know, all these things, like, you know, naturally, like, computers were the thing.
One on top of the other, right? It starts from what you see around.
You graduate to the next.
Yes.
Correct. Right. And I, yeah, very soon, I'm traveling to Bombay, like, you know, via the local train. My Gujarat Mail was the train. I was in the local coach or the general coach, the unreserved compartment. And, you know, I would travel here. I would walk from Bombay Central to Lamington Road. I would collect, I'll wait for, because I would be there by 7:30, right? The shops would open at 11. So you have to hang around on the side of the street waiting for the shop to open. Yeah, I had nothing, I had no money. So there's no tea, coffee or breakfast. Like, you know, I'm just hanging like a bum. I mean, I'm waiting for the shops to open, the shop owner to show up. And then I would say, I need 4 MB RAM and I need this hard drive, etc. And again, you observe and you learn and you say, okay, well, the shopkeeper is just like the front end. The actual godown is all the dilapidated buildings that are, you know, like across the street. That's where the warehouses are. And you connect the dots and you're like, okay, what if I just walk into one of these buildings, which don't look like a showroom, but, you know, that's where the stuff is. And can I get, you know, maybe things for cheap? It removes the margin. So I started doing that. And I would travel then all the way back to Ahmedabad with the you know, with all the electronic components.
Pick up your parts and
and assemble the PC, deliver it, take the money, and then sleep because I would have not have slept for 48 hours. So a lot of my life, like you say, I mean, and Gujarat Mail is a night train. When you are in unreserved compartment, there is no space to even stand. Yeah, so I would, and this might sound very funny, but it, the a train bogey, like a coach, has four doors, two on each side. You prop the door open and you sit on top of the door inside the compartment. And you have to hunch your neck because it's touching the roof of the...
Oh, my God.
Yes. And you have to lock your legs, otherwise you'd fall off from the top.
So that's a long...
That would
long
be the entire... Yes, it definitely felt long. You can't even take a nap or you just fall down and then you might just be fall out of the train. And that was the entire night. So, you know, that's why I said when I, when you arrive at the Bombay Central Station, you walk to Lamington Road and there is nothing to do because if you had money, you would probably get a reserved seat or you'd go buy Muscaban or something like, you know, like a tea. But you just hang in there like, you know. Anyway, so you not slept that night, and then when you are assembling the PC, you're too excited, like to put everything together. You know, yeah. Then you have to load the operating system. Then you have to load all the software. Then you're like all nice and good, and then you go and deliver it, and then you take the money, and then you sleep for like whatever, how much time. So entrepreneurial, like you said, you've been entrepreneurial, right? Like this entrepreneurship is like multiple things, whether it's electrical stuff, electronics, selling soap, assembling PCs. This is all kind of disconnected. And I've also written software, you know, in that whole computer business. Like I said, I taught myself how to write software. So a friend who had a PC back then, I did not, both of us got together and then we wrote software for advocates. This is early 90s, year 1993, 94.
Wow, and that's pretty niche. And so walk me through that journey. How did you make that transition? It's a bit, you know, my question here is learning software is a bit different than working in electronics where you can see it and learn by doing, right? There is some theory. So how did you kind of make that shift?
Yeah, good question. Great question, actually. So I was, so there is a Vikram Sarabhai lab in Ahmedabad. And I, school friend, told me, hey, why don't you come? They have computers and they'll give us access to computers. I had absolutely no idea what a computer is. I mean, you can think like, you know, that, hey, it's something that computes, but you have no idea what the hell it is, right? So I'm on my bicycle. I go all the way halfway across the length of Ahmedabad, and we go to Vikram Sarabhai Labs, which is inside the PRL, like, you know, physics research lab. This is all part of the Vikram Sarabhai kind of, you know, campus. And they used to give kids access 30 minutes to a computer, BBC Micros, and let them play games. And in one of those sessions, I entered the edit mode.
Of the game, and then you're like, wow.
And, and I'm like, okay, there's some, you know, gibberish written, like, it's gibberish most of the time. But, you know, like, you can make some numbers, like, you know, and then let's say it's let A equals 20, right? And you're like, okay, what if I make it 30 and let's see what happens, right? And I go back, I change that, I go back into the game mode, and you realize, okay. So unlike...
Something changed.
Unlike fixing electronics, or even if you did not fix, let's say you wanted to produce like doorbells, right? Mm. You would need a factory, you would need capital, you need to buy all the parts. In this thing, I did not know it was called software, like, but I said in this computer program thing, like, you know, all you need is time, and, you know, you can just change these things and the output changes. How cool is that? And I can do this all day long. So that was the starting point of me seeing a computer. That's and crazy. Then I enrolled into AppTech. And AppTech, while they were teaching us, you probably don't even know all this, but there was a program called WordStar. Think of it as the granddaddy of MS Word. And there was Lotus 1-2-3, which was word processing and spreadsheet. Yeah, but for DOS, and this is mid-90s I'm talking about. So while they were teaching all this, because we had the courseware books, a friend and me, like, you know, who were batchmates or seatmates in AppTech, we taught ourselves DBase and FoxPro, which are programming languages. And since he had a computer, we would go and practice this all night on his computer, right? So one day his dad challenged us. He says, hey, you know, we're spending so much money on this AppTech thing, and, you better... be very good at it, like, you know, I will really, I challenge you to, like, you know, build something, we know all these advocates, can you build, not only address book management, but, like, you know, billing software for them, right? Like, so this customer gave me 20,000 rupees or 50, or whatever amount, right? Like a billing and contact management, can you do that?
Okay.
And then we took it up. We were actually very hurt because we thought that we were actually, you know, crushing it until my friend's dad challenged us. We're like, okay, we'll show him, man. Let's do it. So in month three of AppTech, we actually built the program out. And then we left AppTech because we already knew whatever they were going to teach us over the next 18 months. So... it was a 2-year course, and then the last would be like programming and all that, right? So we taught ourselves that. And then we were busy selling that. So, you know, so that was the transition from electrical, electronics, so assembling PCs, selling software.
To making software.
And so whenever, like, you know, I get an opportunity, you know, you got to figure out how to be entrepreneurial about it. How do you take whatever you have, convert it into something that, makes you money? I've done that multiple times.
Nice. And so, you know, to talk about the other side of your professional journey, you then went on to do your BCom, I believe, in academics. You said it before, was never really an interest. So how did you kind of walk through your professional journey? And I'm sure that must have been that thought that, hey, this is what everyone else is doing and everyone's going and getting a job at a corporate. Was that ever an option for you?
No, actually, it was not, because I used to suck at all things accounting and commerce and economics and everything that they taught in school. Like I said, right, because of my family situation, I was very distracted as a student. Like, to me, studying is not going to put food on the table, right? You know, so I have to, like, do things outside. I have to go step outside of home and figure out a way to make money. Now, being a kid doesn't help you. You know, you don't have any gravitas. You don't have, like, you know, communication. There's no one to hold your hand. You know, you're,
Which is the other thing. I mean, I find it amazing that you sold software to lawyers as a kid, right? How did you pull that off?
So I wasn't a kid anymore then, but I was like 17, 18, like around the time frame, 2 years. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, sure. Like, you know, now, I mean, with my age now, I can say I was a kid back then, but I was pretty, I mean, I had a Luna, like a moped back then. So I'm helping my mom out on one side. On the other side, you know, there is all these exotic things that I'm working on, which family has absolutely no idea what I'm doing because they don't know what the hell is software, right? And what is computers? Yeah. And they're like, what are you even doing? So all that is going on one side. And then I'm helping my mom out with her stitching business, right? So she's like, okay, well, there is a sari we need to, you know, there is a fall we need, you know, so saris have falls and then you have to go and get a matching color petticoat and a blouse and a fall and all that, so on. And can you rush to the, you know, the wholesale market and go find these things? Or you have to go, you know, we had an interlock machine. So sometimes when you'd get these things, I would be the one on the machine interlocking it. And in the night, I would be writing software. So life was pretty wild or diverse, if you can call it like that. There are multiple personalities, right, at the same time. Studies to me, academics to me was just the reason I joined a morning college was so that I can get away with it first thing in the morning. And then the rest of the day is mine. So college was, you know, from 8 to 10:30. And honest to God, like, you know, I probably not attended more than 50 days in all 3 years because it's BCom, so it's 3 years. And we used to get the question paper, like, you know, in fact, the guy, it's such a great coincidence. The college friend who used to arrange for the question paper visited me. He's in New York and he came to see me yesterday. And he's like, man, we have come a long way since those days. And it was amazing to recount some parts of the journey, right? So, but he remembers that, you know, I had absolutely no idea. The only reason that I would go and study to his place because one, he had an air conditioner. Two, he was from Hindi medium. I was from an English medium. So, you know, his parents thought, you know, if you hang around with Anand, your English will improve, you know, and if there are any words in the textbook that you don't understand, he can tell you. And to me, I was just waiting for the daybreak. Like, you know, once it's morning, I can go back to doing what I love, which is electronics, electrical, software, assembling PCs, you know, all those things, which has nothing to do with BCom. So I did graduate, but it was very painful for me because it was literally, I would have graduated in some other language, if you want to call it like that, like with absolutely no love for it. But I had to force myself to graduate because, you know, you need to graduate. So, yes. And I got a glowing, I think, 55% marks, you know, that too after copying the... So
let's talk about the other side of it. And Burp was your first tech startup, I guess you can call it. That was in 2009. So can you tell us a bit about that and your journey? Why did you come up with the idea first and how did you build it out?
Yeah, so between the assembling PCs and writing software for advocates and Burp, I actually did end up going to the US. I spent about 7 years there working for one of the hottest startups at that point of time. So I was in the Bay Area. I was in San Francisco, actually, working for a very hotshot startup. And I'll skip that part of the story. You know, maybe if you want, I can touch upon that part. But I worked for a company called Breyens.
Yes, please.
And then I worked for... Yeah, I worked for AT&T Wireless and then Motorola was the last stint. And then, you know, I was just, I never wanted to go to the US in the first place, to be honest. So I was handpicked from India to go work for that company, that startup from India. Because it's hard. I mean, you're a commerce graduate. You are a, you know, you're not good in academics. You are a street hustler, if I can call myself that. And, you know, there's no way in hell that, you know, you are applying for a H-1B or... because they need a STEM education and they need good academics. And please mind, I mean, this is the late 90s, right? So you have all the IIT folks and the Bits Pilani and everyone else, right? So I got handpicked. I was there. And I always wanted to come back because, you know, the more you are in the US, you read about the center of gravity shifting towards Asia and, you know, like a 2 billion give or take people between China and India. And, you know, like that's where opportunities lie. So I did one thing. I was in Seattle. When I came back just before that, I was in Seattle. I This time I did not self-learn things. I actually had a tutor who taught me Mandarin. So I learned Mandarin 6 months, and then I immersed myself into the whole Chinese culture, watching movies without the subtitles and, you know, in the Chinese festival and all those things. And then I came back. So I said, you know what, even if India is biased like that, where they'll say, hey, where is your engineering degree? Or I don't get a job in Infosys. I mean, please understand, this is the year 2005, 2006. And I said, there was no Flipkart. There's nothing happening in India. There was no Google in India. Okay. So I said, if I will not get a job with Infosys because, you know, of the engineering class system, maybe I should go, at least they will hire me because I can speak Mandarin and I can maybe translate code for the, you know, Chinese people or whatever. So that was my hedge. And then when I came back in India, I did two things. One is Burp, which you know about. You know, I started again out of a whim because India, you see the call centers are starting to show up and dial-up internet penetration is happening. And you think that, hey, people want to go out and eat out. And there are all sorts of these fancy places showing up. To me, growing up, eating out would have been go to a South Indian place and you have dosa, the Gujarati version of the dosa, whatever that means, right? And you realize that, hey, there are all sorts of cuisines, like, you know, there is Japanese, wow, and there is, you know, people like me would be struggling to find out, like, you know, what do you go and order in a Japanese restaurant or what kind of cuisine is it? Is it vegetarian? Is it not? You know, do you have to eat it with chopsticks or whatever? So we said, you know what, we can start a food review and like a listing and a review site. So that was Burp, but the one thing that you also, like, you know, now, because I was an NRI back then, you know, I also started noticing the problem of pigeons in India. I'm like, man, there are too many pigeons. I mean, the pigeons were always there, but I started noticing that problem. So I'm like, I got to do something about this because, you know, for the first time in my life, we could afford window ACs. So I had a, you know, like a 2-bedroom place I bought after I came back from the US. Window ACs are there. And then on the window ACs, there are pigeons and the pigeons are cooing. And you're like, dude, this sucks. We need to do something about it. And then you try to shoo them away, they obviously they come back. So I said, you know what? In Bombay, I've seen, like, you know, this 5-star JW Marriott and Taj and all these guys have this bird spike. I did not know what they were called, but I knew that they had spiky, pointy things on top. And I asked the hotel manager, etc. Like, you know, I said, hey, where do you get these things? So they're like, we import this. I'm like, okay, what is the cost? He's like, 700 rupees a running foot. I'm like, okay, well, it was way beyond my, you know, just for the pigeons, I'm not going to spend 700 rupees running foot. Because you have to put it across the ledge on all the surfaces of the house. You have to put it on the balcony, all the windows. So it would have cost me at least 25 to 30,000 rupees. So, you know, like I was telling, how do you end up being an entrepreneur when you spot opportunities? I said, you know what? What if we can make them in India? So I spent 5 lakh rupees of my own. You know, since I knew AutoCAD, I sat down with an AutoCAD expert and I designed the die, the spike, and all
of those things. You made a pigeon spike yourself.
We manufactured that. And I would also go and that is not where it ended. It ended where when I started installing it. So on the weekends and evenings, I would go install the bird spike. I have multiple installations in hospitals, in temples, in buildings. I have done it. It's not like I had a team or whatever. I would hang from the terrace of the building, you know, and I would install it and then I would go up. And then I was also writing software for Burp, like, you know, because I was the CTO there. So there's like multiple things, very different at the same time.
How did you move from installing pigeon spikes to CleverTap? I think that's a very big leap. So if you can talk us through that and talk us through CleverTap as well. Like what was the original idea? Have you changed from there? Maybe it might be a good time to segue into that.
So Burp took off, actually. So at some point of time, we became the de facto, and this is before Zomato's time and Swiggy's time, we became the de facto guide. And there was a cult-like following for Burp. Restaurants would put up Burp certified, and a lot of people would, like, you know, came and started writing reviews. CNN voted us as the top 30 places to work outside of Silicon Valley in the world. And mind you, we were in a 1-bedroom apartment. When it started to take off, I had to get I had to get rid of the bird spike business because I didn't have time for that. So I gave it to a friend and I asked him to run it. And like whatever money he makes, or I said, just keep the money. I don't really care. But, you know, hey, just make sure there are no pigeons. Take care of the pigeons. I'll take care of the rest of the stuff. We ran Burp for about 3 years. The one thing I was telling Mazin, like, you know, that back in the days, in 2006, it was extremely hard to find venture capital. It is not that we did not have VCs back then, right? We had Sequoia, we had Bluestone, we had like a bunch of Clearstone, not Bluestone. Blue Run and Clearstone, they're two different ones. We had all of those varieties, right? But when you went and spoke to them, they didn't understand the consumer. Like, you know, if you were doing something in the B2B side, they'd be interested in that. So after getting rejected about 30 times, you know, we just couldn't, like, I mean, I was running it bootstrapped with my money. And I had a co-founder and he put some capital too. After a while, we actually found Infomedia 18, whose Yellow Pages business was kind of on the decline. And they said, hey, you guys are the startup guys. You seem to be very cool. And you understand technology. We have some Yellow Pages company. Can we not join forces? So we kind of got acquired by Infomedia 18. We were there. And then Infomedia 18 merged into Network 18. When I left Network 18, I was there for 4 years already. And this idea of, how do you understand your user? So to, you know, like, let's say we are meeting for the first, we actually are like meeting here for the first time. But the second time when we meet, like, you know, you would probably remember some of my stories. And there is a prior context, right? And we hit it off. Like, it's not like we're going to introduce ourselves with our names and all that, right? So how come when we go to websites or when we launch apps, you know, they completely forget who we are. They show us products that we don't care about. They pretend to have never seen us. You know, they show us colors and sizes that we don't care about, and just random products, like whatever they want to sell as opposed to what we want to buy. This thing never happens in a shop. When you go to a shop, you know, like your usual place, they know what you came looking for, right? Or if you say that, hey, I don't want to this color, etc., they kind of quickly adapt and understand. Oh, are you work in an office, like a corporate job? Okay, so let me show you something that's not very wild and wacky, but more pinstripes and check shirt. And, you know, you get my drift, right? So can we make technology that that understands the user better and gives them what they came looking for? These are called insights and personalization now, but, you know, to simplify that. And we realized that the problem is not the intent of the marketer or the growth person on the other side. The intent is that the problem is the technology. There is no technology that can solve it. So in the year 2013, we quit our job. So we are three founders. The other two I met in Infomedia / Network 18. We quit our jobs and we started CleverTap. And we solved it as a tech problem. We did not want to go disrupt the landscape or the space or go kill some competition or whatever. We actually thought that, you know, can we make all the communication that happens between a brand and a user, and the other way around too, like, you know, more personalized, can we make it more relevant so you get what you came looking for as opposed to whatever they want to sell, they're shoving down, your throat.
And how did you convince your first customers? And maybe I'll lay some context. It's 10 years ago. So SaaS was just in its very early days. I think in the US it had started to pick up, but in India it was not really a big deal. How did you get that idea that you're going to deliver it on cloud? How did you get your customers? I'm assuming a lot of them were abroad. And like, what was the positioning? What did you sell to them?
Great questions. We did everything that was not in the book. So number one, we were stealth for 3 years, almost 30 months. Since it's a technology problem, we looked around. So there were three problems that we wanted to, or three core hypotheses that we wanted to kind of work on, right? Number one is the amount of data is going to grow exponentially, right? People are going to spend more time on the phone, more time on digital devices, and the amount of data that we leave as footprint, like, you know, like we the interactions with the app or on the website is going to grow, number one. Number two, the attention span is going to be even shorter, right? It's not that you're sitting with a newspaper and you're spending 2 hours reading the newspaper, right? you are on this website one, and then you jump onto an app and so on and so forth, right? So the attention span of the consumer is going to be shorter. The third thing is that if you are a marketer on the other side, or if you're a growth person on the other side, you know, you don't want to wait 24 hours for the report. As the amount of data grows, you want to quickly react to your business. Now, this happens in the real world, right? In the real world, if you someone gets off a Rolls Royce and walks into a Croma, I don't think so that they're going to tell him, like, you know, hey, there is a USB buy one, get one free offer, right? They probably are going to talk to that person with a bit of respect and ask the person, hey, you know, are you looking for something? You know, are you looking for, you know, see this largest television we have, or this, I don't know, 5-door refrigerator we have, or whatever it is, like the most costliest product in their this thing, right? So what they recognize some signals and then they react to that. And for us, we couldn't find any technology that was real time, that allowed you to store unlimited amount of data, and you know, can kind of address a very broad range of use cases. So the first 30 months of our startup life, we were building this core technology, which we now call as Tesseract DB. And we said that we need to invent technology, and that we have now we filed for a few patents along the years, and now they've come. So now we are getting those patents approved. So we have quite a few handful of patents now, and a few more are expected during the course of this year. So we invented this core technology, the Tesseract, and that took us 30 months to build version one of that. And then we started building the product around that. So unlike traditional wisdom, which says, hey, build an MVP and then go sell it, we actually did not do that, you know. And I'll come to that part in a second. But the second thing that we did, which was unconventional, was we started selling in India. So you're like, you know what? Indian customers must be buying. So everyone told us, you know what? Learn from all the, you know, so there was the Freshworks, there was Zoho, and build in India and sell to the West. And be like, okay, why should you go halfway across the world when you have customers right here in your backyard? I mean, they are customers too. Like, you know, they'll pay you money. And I'm still fighting that challenge. Like, you know, a lot of the startup early stage guys come to me and say, how did you crack North America? I said, why do you want to crack North America? I mean, you are an early stage company. You should have a close product feedback loop. And you cannot have it like, you know, a tight feedback loop halfway across the world unless you are there and your engineers are there and everyone of your team is in North America. I understand that part. But if you're in India, India is a big enough market. So we literally started selling 3 years after starting CleverTap and 30 months being in stealth, we started selling to, I would not say startups, and I will talk about that in a minute, started selling in India. So that's very unconventional. And we did not build a niche or a tip of the spear product. We actually built, our version one of the product had analytics. So good, useful insights on the user. We had segmentation, grouping people by behavior. And then we had the engagement channel, so you could send a push notification or an email to your user. So based on what you learn about the user, the insights, you can segment them and then you can send them a message. And you can measure the impact of, you know, whatever you told them. It's like, you know, when I'm telling you, hey, let's grab coffee, let's say 9 p.m. and you put on a little smirk on your face like saying that, dude, this is not the time for coffee. I can very quickly react to that, right? I can maybe offer you beers saying, Aviral, forget the coffee, man. Let's go for beers. And you'd be like, yes, that's now you're speaking my language, right? So can a brand react in a similar way to what the user responded to their message or not, right? So we built that whole loop. So unlike a small niche product for a certain vertical, we actually built something that is very broad. And then we started selling it in India.
So unlike, typical SaaS companies, and I obviously invest and work with a few SaaS businesses, you took a more R&D kind of approach, which was 3 years, you built out stuff and then you went to market, which is quite interesting. And the other thing you did was you went to India first. Another very unique thing about what you guys do and did was that you were working with a bunch of platforms and solving for multiple industries. So there's like a lot of dimensionality that's attached to that as well. So like you were alluding to earlier, there were like a lot of decisions you took which were not what people would have thought. And I believe nonlinear decisions lead to nonlinear outcomes. So how did you do that? How did you execute it? Was there stress in the team? You were like a almost a multi-pronged, multi-industry platform. How did that play out? And maybe if you can talk about 2016 onwards till maybe 2020.
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me start before 2016, because a lot of decisions are made in the formation years for us. The decision to like be in stealth and continue to build for 30 months, like this database that we are actually not going to sell. So I'm not in the base. I'm not a database company. I'm a marketing automation company. But we wanted it to be a certain caliber or a certain capability, right? So that was one, right? Two is, to approach venture capitalists. So we approached like Axel and without a product, obviously. And 1 year into building the company, we said that we're building a database and it's a real-time database, etc. And they're like, are you in a database company? We're like, no, we are marketing automation, but we have to get this part right. And of course, they grilled us like, 1 year, man, come on, sell the product, build an MVP. Of course, there is all this yarn around the internet, right? Like MVP and go sell it and early product market fit. And all. We said, no, hold on. That, we'll get to all that, right? But this is very important. And of course, when they grilled us deeper into why does the world need a database, it was year 2014, we actually could whiteboard the problem, right? We said the amount of data, the things I just said, right? Amount of data is going to grow exponentially and all that. We're like, okay, this is interesting. And we can put some money into the startup. So we were very lucky to get seed round, seed capital from Axel in 2014. And then we hired my engineers from Burp, my previous startup. A lot of them were raring to come back and work. So in that sense, I was able to attract, early talent, committed talent, without too much of the questioning of, of course, each person I had to bring on board, I had to convince them, why are we doing what we are doing? So the why of the decision is very important, and not because Anand said so, because I want people to find holes in my theory. The sooner they find it, the better we can course correct, right? But, if you find it out about 3, 4, 5 years later, it's too late. You probably burn through the capital and then people are like, oh, but I was about to tell you, like, this is a bad idea. So that was good. Selling in India also was very interesting because, when you're 30 months into stealth, you want to go talk to someone, right? Now, because of Network 18, I knew Ashish Himrajani, who's the founder of Book My Show. And one day out of the blue, he calls me and says, hey, dude, I'm wondering, every one of our users gets the same damn newsletter. So we started this newsletter thing about a year ago. And, whether you watch Odia movies or you watch Bhojpuri movies or Telugu movies or whatever, you get the same damn thing. You're a family of four, same newsletter. College student, same newsletter. Can we change it a bit? So I've asked my team to create these multiple versions. But it's like painful. I said, Ashish, which office are you in? It's like, I'm in the Juhu office. I said, just hold it there. I'll be there in 30 minutes. And like we do in Bombay, I took an auto rickshaw, went to his office and I started whiteboarding the answer. I said, let's say we learn from the.
Anand, I must say the hustle is crazy, man. I mean, it's incredible. It's awesome. I mean, story of you hanging from terraces, saving buildings from pigeons. Incredible, man. It was awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. So the idea, of course, Ashish got the drift and he says, okay, I'll kill the project. Can you put something up in 3 weeks? Actually, he said, I'll give you by Monday, let's put this thing in. I said, no, Ashish, it's only an idea, man. There's nothing real. We're still whiteboarding because we're building a database. So anyway, we got through that hump, and he was instrumental, actually. He was the one that actually introduced Axel. We did not wake up one day and says, let's go talk to Axel. He sent an email to Axel, to Shekhar and Prashant, saying that you should talk to these guys. I have no freaking idea what they're working on, but it seems real and it seems like very convincing. And that's how they came over to Mumbai and grilled us on what database are you building? Why are you building that? So getting some customers to adopt your product, and we did not worry about what the website, there was no website. Trust me, after Series A also, we did not have a website. I mean, we had a blog, a WordPress. So WizRocket, I mean, that was my company called WizRocket, it's now CleverTap, but WizRocket.wordpress.org. And we didn't care because who's going to be in the stealth mode? Who cares about your website? I know people put up all sorts of fancy websites and sign up here, be the first one to preview. But like, who cares really? Number one. Number two, we said pricing is a topic that we will deal with later. First, we need to find people who are interested in the product. You know, you can always price it, right? Let's say you are the founder of Rolls-Royce and you decide to make like a very expensive car. You need to find people who are interested in the car, and then you can figure out the price, right? Whether it's going to be cost plus or some other exotic pricing scheme. So you need to find market for that. And with Ashish and a few others, like, you know, we were able to find interest. And for us to find out, like, you know, whether the product is, like, for the lack of any better analogy, a vitamin or a painkiller for them, was that we were watching our own dashboards. And when you see that the usage of CleverTap went from, you know, once every week on Friday, just to see how the bookings were doing, to Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This is the movie business, right? So Fridays is where the action is, Friday, Saturday, the weekend, to then multiple people logging in during the weekend, and then everyone in the company logging in all days of the week. That's when you know that you're getting more and more entrenched in their business. And it's not like a nice to have, you know, hey, go, let's go check CleverTap's dashboard because it's Monday morning, boss asked for some report. It is not that. Actually, they're fully dependent on that. And that to me is like a vital moment for you to discover that, you know, you've discovered product market fit. It is not because someone pays you. It's because someone's actually using your product and not just paying you for it. Because, you know, you can pay for 1 year. You can fool them once. They can pay you for 1 year. Then they'll churn. And for 1 year, you'll think you have product market fit. That's not that to me, in my definition, that's not product market fit. So,
amazing.
So, I mean, I have some strong theories, but they're like I was telling Mazin, like, you know, they're from practice and not from theory.
Amazing. And can you talk about, you know, 16 onwards, building out the company? How did you build competitive advantage? What really helps you succeed even today? I think you might have set the foundation for that in those, you know, 7 years from then to now.
From 16 on, so 16 is when we finally came out of stealth. We got a website and we had a pricing model, and then we went out in the market. The greatest thing for us that happened right after we came out of stealth is instead of trying to sell the product through slideware, you know, hey, look at the PPT or some great fancy, you know, Axel Sico has invested and all these things. We actually said and by the way, when we came out of stealth, we had both Axel and Sequoia, which is now Peak 15, as our investors, right? So they came in 1 year later and they put in, you know, $8 million Series A. So we were very well capitalized, right? And we had some, probably the strongest globally, but also definitely in India, the strongest investors, right? Again, one of my theories is to not go seek investor introductions. Because, you know, some founder is going to take a meeting, maybe they'll buy the product also, but I would not really know whether my product is selling or not. So minus the investor introductions, we actually went out and we started showing the product to anyone that cared, whether it's an airport, railway station, coffee shop, bar, I didn't care. Every opportunity I got, I would show. So even when I'm on a vacation, I'd carry my laptop and I'd be ready to jump into a demo, 30 seconds, time it takes for MacBook to start. I'd be ready with my demo. And this is not some stupid HTML demo. This is a real product with real data. And, you know, like you actually are showing a product. And guess what happened? Like, you know, my year one customers were Book My Show because they signed up very early on. But we also Zomato. We had Jio. We had Urban Company. And we had Practo. So we got five of the who's who of the Indian ecosystem. And they signed up with us. And when they signed up with us, they started using the product. So we took off for all the things that we had theories around, like, you know, of course, practice is when the rubber meets the road is when we took off. And if you think about this, each of these businesses, Jio is a telecom operator, Book My Show is like an e-commerce, Zomato is food, you know, food delivery now, but also restaurant booking, etc. back then, they're very, very different from each other. So the proof of whether this product works for multiple domains or not was right there. Happy to report, by the way, they all still my customers after 7 years.
You are a retention company retaining your earliest customers.
It would be very ironical if you're not able to retain people, customers. But thankfully, we have been able to. And I think what, like you said, the decisions then, right? So since we took off in India, we actually focused in India. We said, you know what? We are seeing traction. And like the same hustle, Viral, like, you know, customer has a problem, I jump on it right away. Of course, now we are 650 people. So we have a team, customer success, we have all sorts of people. But if I need to get involved, I get involved directly with customers. And because there's an opportunity to learn. And for India, so 2016, 17 and 18 were for us natural expansion geographies were India, all of it, and then expanding into Southeast Asia. And then 19 is when we did two rounds of capital back to back, like, you know, so Tiger Global got involved. We had series B and C. And we started expanding into, you know, geographies like North America, Europe, Latin America. So we started opening up. Of course, Sunil, my third co-founder, you know, we sent him back to the US very early on. So right after series seed, we sent Sunil back to the Bay Area. So he was always there. And we had, you know, we had our CPO there. Although we are all tech guys, you know, we can play the role of CTO, CPO. But, you know, we had a professional like CPO. And we were doing good business, right? And so from until 19, we had less than a percentage of churn across our enterprise segment.
After India, you chose to go to US, and you know Sunil actually moved out there. Can you walk us through that thought process? Why the US next? Why did you choose it as a market?
Yeah, one thing that's important to keep in mind is this was year 2014. Yes, 2014, right? 2014, around 15 is when Sunil left. The predominant emotion back then was that you have to go list on NASDAQ and you need to have substantial numbers. So while India was kind of taking off, we did not know how it will fully play out, right? So we were lucky we got early customers. And of course, Jio boom kind of, you know, spawned a lot more startups because data became cheaper and all that. But you do not know how it's going to play out, right? So, and US is one of the deepest markets for enterprise software. And there are all these aspirational brands, right? Even if you're selling to someone in India, wouldn't you want Amazon or Netflix or an Expedia to become your customer, right? Wouldn't you want a Nike to shine, right? So US has the most aspirational brands, not just from a US perspective, from a global perspective. So for us, going to US, well, sending Sunil was one small step for CleverTap, if I can use that word. So that go establish a beachhead, like, you know, learn what are the differences. I've lived there. Sunil obviously has lived there in the US. But are there any nuances or differences in the market? For example, US, like, you know, is a more mature market. They're email heavy. India, like, you know, if you ask any teenager, they probably won't have an email address, you know, or certain side of society. Yeah, we are push notification driven and WhatsApp and whatnot. You don't have these channels in the US. So understand these nuances, because when we come to the West to sell the product, we shouldn't have that problem anymore. So I think that decision to send Sunil to the US was more about learn from the market instead of sell to the market.
You spoke about the importance of having boots on the ground, but how did you go about expanding and picking which markets to move to next?
Yeah. So the one thing that we still believe in is that you cannot run the world from your office in India. You need to have local presence. 2019 when we... And that's why it had to wait for a capital round, right? And that's why the funded businesses are better in my, like you asked me this question early on. We actually set up offices in, you can afford to not take a few mistakes, to kind of, you know, to fall a few times, right? Because you can, as long as you can recover from that fall. So for us, setting up these local offices, whether it is Latin America, hiring locals, you know, whether it's for sales, field marketing, or customer success is very important, right? Because then you are in the region, you're not trying to run everything from India. And of course, please understand that this was like year six of our startup life. So this was not year one decision, right? So we had like an engine in India that was, you know, signing up customers, etc. All this was happening. And we said, okay, how do we go get customers outside of India? And that's where we, so again, one of the lessons is that you have to be in the region. If you're selling an enterprise product, it inspires confidence. You can show up. And we still do we still have the offices in all the geographies I mentioned, whether it's Southeast Asia, whether it's Middle East, Europe, Latin America. And you need to put a face in the region. And that is a very important thing. Also, those people kind of send back feedback, right? Like, hey, the regulations or a local data center or, what's important in that region. Again, you learn from your customers and then you bake that into the product roadmap and you build on that.
When it comes to innovation and adding value to customers, what are some of the things that CleverTap does differently?
The technology. We are first and foremost a technology company because even when the talk of the town these days is Gen AI, all of this is actually we can leverage it because of the technology investment we made when we at the beginning of the company, right? Since then, it is not the same engine. We have actually upgraded the engine 3 times. We are in version 3 of Tesseract DB, which makes it literally limitless, right? It is the only database that's purpose built for marketing automation, right? For messaging. And that gives us a unique advantage, right? That means our customers don't face any limitations or any overages or any surprises when they're running their campaigns. They can leverage AI to understand their users better. They can leverage AI to send a message. And this feature is called Scribe. They can send a message that resonates emotionally better with the users. So if you are a bank, you probably don't want to create a format with your users, right? You're probably aiming for trust as the predominant emotion. So you can send a message that's centered around trust. And that to me is like a use of Gen AI as opposed to, and that's a plus on Gen AI as opposed to just using it as a raw feature. And all of this becomes the secret sauce when you put it together.
You learned sales early on in your career, but tell us, how did you sell CleverTap to customers? What was your pitch?
Yeah, I think one important aspect of running a business is to be empathetic to your customers. So when you have customers, let's just take one example, right? So we have food delivery, we have fintech, we have retail, we have streaming apps, we have gaming. These are all multiple industries that we serve. But let's just take one example. Let's say food delivery business, right? Food delivery business, you need to be empathetic to how do they run their business? What is their North Star, right? And how can your product help them reach that North Star, right? Or improve their business KPIs. It is not a messaging software that we are selling. It's not like, just write the message and send it and hope for the best. We actually promise growth. We actually promise that you can improve customer lifetime value using CleverTap. And how does that happen exactly? Well, it happens because you have insights on the users. You are segmenting them better. You are predicting, what the user behavior is going to be and going to react to that. When you do all of this, and it feeds back into the insights, like depending upon how someone reacted or not, it comes back. Now, your customer doesn't really, is not thinking about you all the time. Think of any product that we use. We don't think about that product all the time. So it's for you as a business to go and educate your customers, number one. You need to show them what is more that can happen. So what happens with the regional teams is that they get an opportunity to come back to CleverTap and share best practices, right? Hey, in this region, this streaming app, their subscription rates are through the roof, and this is the strategy that they employ. And we get to then share it with the, so I think some strategies, of course, we don't share data or numbers or any of that, but best practices, and you learn from the best, right? And to that, your customer completely appreciates. So I think that is a good loop that we have going. We meet our customers through quarterly business reviews. We do management business reviews or executive business reviews. We have customer success. We train them on the product. We also seek their advice as we, finalize the roadmap, figure out what's to build next. So there are all sorts of things that we do with our customers to keep them engaged with us. And then, of course, we benefit also from that.
Can you tell us a little bit about the culture at CleverTap? What's it like?
I can say this on behalf of all the folks that work at CleverTap. We are not a very uptight organization. It's not like, hey, we actually are a lot of fun and we are self-deprecating. I mean, we don't have everything perfect. I mean, like any other company in the world, but it's not that we are some big tiny model of success. We are getting better every day. But how can you make sure? And of course, having a young workforce means there are all the you know, fun things that like, I'll give an example, right? Like, we have a CT meme channel where some of dedicated folks actually create memes. So this is not HR problem, or this is not like Anand, like, you know, there are people who create memes, like, you know, they're self-deprecating jokes that get shared on that, and everyone goes in as a chuckle at that. We celebrate as teams. You know, we also reflect quite a bit on how could we get better. We recently did a little pulse survey. So from that, we kind of gauge, like, you know, whether the fun factor is going away or not, or whether all the teams, we celebrate all festivals across the globe. Since we are a global company, we also share pictures, like, you know, if some region did, for example, we have a large development center in Bulgaria, Sofia. So the local customs there, like, you know, when they celebrate that, we in India also celebrate their customs. And that's a fun thing to do, like, you know, across the globe. It also sensitizes your team to various cultures.
How are you thinking about the future for CleverTap, given where you are today? You're very well positioned, you know, to continue being a leader in the space. But what are the things that you are going to double down on? How do you see AI coming into the mix for you? Maybe if you could share that and talk about that.
One of the things that we look forward to the future is we dominate this side of the world quite a bit. So working with, like I said, food tech industries, or food delivery, restaurant booking, in the fintech sector, whether it's a bank or it's a wallet, BNPL, or even these multiple super apps, like, you know, there are fintech super apps, right? In one app, you can do multiple things, insurance. So we do that, right? We want to, in the future, we see more, like, different kinds of businesses emerge. We want to be able to service them. One huge opportunity that we see in front of us is the gaming opportunity. We do have gaming customers in India. We work with Dream 11. There is a Mobile Premier League. We have Winzo Games. And we do have gaming customers all over the world. But can we go do more with them? So, you know, with this problem statement, or what more can we do with them, we acquired a company called Lean Plum. In 2022. And with that acquisition came in a lot of gaming capabilities. I mean, they have customers like Electronic Arts, Tilting Point, MobilityWare, NextPick Games, and so on and so forth, right? So, and they specialize in gaming, which is product A/B testing, live ops, remote config. So can we bake that, can we take those capabilities and put it on the CleverTap platform? Given the Tesseract DB engine we have, this is going to fly off, like, you know, because that kind of capability, no other gaming company has ever, even if you build it in-house, you're not going to make that happen. I know it's a tall claim, but we have customers that can substantiate that claim. So it's a proven thing. So I look forward to that. You know, we have almost come to an end of the feature parity project, where we took all the Lean Plum capabilities and put them on the CleverTap platform. And starting this month, we are going to start migrating the Lean Plum customers onto CleverTap. And that to me is like an amazing opportunity that I look forward to, you know, getting those customers onto CleverTap and showing them everything that we've built for the last 7 years is super exciting for me. So that's one thing that I look forward to. The second thing is, North America is the deepest SaaS market or software market in the world. How can we go and have a massive brand in that region and that market? So that is something also that we're investing in. I'm personally taking an interest in that. So these are the couple of things that we look forward to next year.
And I think your ability to build for more emerging style markets, I know, you know, South America is a little ahead of, you know, this region, but there are a lot of similarities. I think that would help you position yourselves well, both from a cost delivery positioning perspective. That's super interesting. So geographical expansion and getting deeper into new sectors is what you're sharing as what's next. And what about AI in this? Is it yes. Going to be a big focus, or, you know, hey, it's for others to do?
No, not really. Actually, we are at a very good intersection of AI. So I was telling Mazen that customers primarily use CleverTap to learn from their customers, getting insights, and then send them a personalized message. Now, what message to send? Who do you send it to? How often do you send? What is the dominant emotion in that message? Should we send? Should we use an emoji or not? Etc. Is all at the intersection of AI. Can you use AI to make that better? Can you use AI to recommend products that are more relevant to you? So we have been investing in this. Gen AI is now the latest buzzword, but for the last, I would say, 5 years, we've been on this. We actually ship a full-blown recommendation engine with CleverTap. Leveraging Gen AI, we have Scribe, which is the emotionally relevant message creator. We have IntelliNode, which automatically finds out the best converting path. So given a set of people and you had to send, now you would not know, should I send a WhatsApp or an email or a push notification? And what is the time delay and how often should I send it? You can actually have IntelliNode, you can create an IntelliNode and it will automatically calibrate that based on the user's reaction. So we have a lot of things and there's a lot more coming this year. On the AI front, related to what is the best time to send, what is the best channel, and can we bubble up interesting audiences, to a marketer, can we enable them to do more? So these are the topics that we are working on, and the brand images. So there's a lot of stuff happening on the AI side for us. It's actually a great thing for us and for our customers.
Well, that makes sense. And just to close with our final question, why we call this Founders Unfiltered. We can have this conversation for a very long time, by the way. I'm having a lot of fun.
Thank
you. What's one piece of unfiltered feedback that you've got, either in your career or majorly as an entrepreneur, because you've been an entrepreneur for so long, that really changed your perspective? And if you had to choose one thing, which was probably brutal, very honest, it'll leave our listeners who are aspiring founders, with something to think about.
So one thing that a very popular entrepreneur in India told me is, Anand, don't focus on valuations, focus on building a business. That person told us when we were raising our Series A. Lock the money. If you think that you're getting a sensible valuation, do not go shop around. Close it, move on, because you have a business to build. And that to me is a fantastic piece of advice. And I've stuck with it every time we have gone and raised money. And every time we think of the business, it is not the valuation, but the business that we have to think about.
Amazing. I mean, and as an investor, I would wholeheartedly agree with you. Because once you're given a term sheet, you do not want. But I definitely agree with you. And I think it's very wise advice, because it's telling you to think about the business and also long term. I think that's the more implicit suggestion. Anand, thank you so much for sharing so openly and honestly. I think you've built a special company and you're a special founder. The energy, you can see the energy in a conversation. It's there. I can see that person who has been building businesses for so long. Thank you so much for sharing with us. We enjoyed it, and I think our listeners will as well.
A pleasure talking to you, Aviral, and Mazen, and sharing my stories. So thank you for having me.